This is low-impact creative writing workshop. You don't have to write if you don't want to, and if you write something, you don't have to read it if you don't want to. So it's not to put anybody on the spot or anything. I want to start by just reading a good piece of writing. I think it's a good way to kind of begin to get good sets of words into our heads. Do I want that one, or do I want this one, or do I want that one? Take them all out. Read composed language, hear composed language together. And, some of us compose language certainly better than others when we speak. Compose language when we write letters, if we still do that. But the kind of language that I'm talking about is art writing, a sort of elevated language. Oh, I can give you paper and pencils if you care for them. Anybody need any? Okay. People who bring their materials to class. Good.
Do you need some paper?
Pardon me?
I need some paper.
Oh, you did need some paper. I'm sorry.
I didn't get any either. I was writing on my envelopes.
Do you have a pencil?
I have a pen. I'd like some paper.
Today was Labor Day. You didn't hand out mail today, did you?
No mail. Oh. I don't do the mail. I'm doing the laundry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh. I just had the question on my mind and you walked in. So.
What?
I just had the question on my mind and you walked in.
I walked in and you got me Mr. Pickens or somebody else.
Yeah.
You must be planning to do an awful lot of writing there, Gene.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. All shrink wrapped together.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You have, I would like one too. Or eight sheets. One.
Thanks. Lottie, what poems have you heard me start with? I'll try not to read something you've heard.
Hunter's Peace.
Hunter, okay. We won't start with that one. Let's see if I...
That's the only one I recall.
Yeah.
Is that the name of it, Hunter's Peace?
Hudson's Peace.
Hudson's Peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to kind of start out hearing some composed language in the and by that I mean language of an art order, elevated language, would always seem like a good possibility. This is excuse me while I change glasses. Mary Oliver, I'm not sure if you know of her work. She did win the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. Contemporary poet. This is a little poem written in couplets. It is contemporary and has one stanza that has a trio of lines. This is called Rain in Ohio. The robin cries, rain. The crow calls, plunder. The black snake climbing in the vines halts his long ladder of muscle while the thunderheads whirl up out of the white west, their dark hooves nicking the tall trees as they come. Rain, 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 sings the robin, frantically, then flies for cover. The crow hunches. The black snake pours himself swift and heavy into the ground. So three characters in the poem, a robin, a crow, and a black snake. Is it giving... very little description of them. in the case of the first two, that you get something of their voices, the call of rain, or the cry of plunder from the crow. But the black snake gives us only his movement as that, you know, liquid going down into the ground. That's a remarkable remarkable piece. Hi, Megan, how are you? Hiding. Now, have you had creative writing workshops before, or been with
good?
Yes? Good. Good. And yourself, sir?
A long time ago.
Okay. So I don't think this will be a scary prospect for anybody. Remember, if you don't want to write, you don't have to, and if you do write, you don't have to read it. So that's all out in front. Writing is a medium that's easiest, probably, of all of them. It's kind of the handball of arts, because you need very little equipment to do it with. You know, in handball, you need a little tiny ball and two little skinny gloves, and that's it. You're ready to go. If we were trying to say, well, we're going to have a session on freeing captivity, but we're using arc welders and masks and, you know, big chunks of steel and stuff, it'd be another matter. But this is a fairly simple one, and it's one that it's very portable. You can take it wherever you go. A thing that I want to say is that I think, just right out front, I think all people are creative. And I think all people have arts that they can do throughout their lives. And I call this an expressive medium, expressive mode. Any time that we're kind of calling from the inside out, then we're in expressive mode. And I would say that most people have two or three or four arts in which they could operate to their own benefit. To their own benefit of feeling of expression, to their own benefit of connecting with the world, their own benefit of expressing the world as they see it outside, or balancing the world as it seems outside and the interior life, which is a rich place, our interior lives. So we're not in this for the money, we're not in this to, you know, be in galleries. Nobody may ever see what we do here, but it's good for us. You know, that's my assumption. I never use the word talent because I don't know what it means, and I try not to use words that I don't know what they mean. Like, I never use the word coincidence because I don't know what that means anymore. It doesn't seem to mean what it used to mean, so I gave up on it. I don't think things happen. I mean, it seems now, doesn't it, to sort of mean things happen by accident. I don't think anything happens by accident. If it were simply a matter of being co-incidents, then two different incidents, I could use it still. So I don't use the word talent. I don't use the word forget, because I don't think it's possible. You know, when we learn something, we get a little convolution in our brain, and just because we can't call it to mind doesn't mean it popped out. So I try to take ownership for that. I try to really put it on me and say, I neglected to remember. And this is leading me to talk about, just for a moment, the linkage between our talking and our writing. My supposition is that you wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in language in a slightly different way, in a slightly more, either a slightly or a great deal different way from many people. I think that people who are interested in language in these ways, it works in their interior life in a different way. I'm convinced of that. That's just from years of working with people who work with language. And often, though, people will pursue and pursue and pursue a writing life, but not really change the way they think about the language that they talk with. And I think it's all linked together. I'm just giving you that as my sort of tip of the day. The best writers I know, and I know many, many writers, are those people who also talk in very riveting ways. They have their own language. Every painter wants their own palette. Every writer wants their own language. I mean, their version in this case of standard American English, their syntacting of their languaging of their composing of the words that are just theirs. Excuse me, I'm awful dry. I assume that there are three things that I'm doing all the time. This will be review for a couple of you, but I'll try to just scream through it here. And it really is a lot like juggling. Gosh, different colors, isn't it great? These are three balls that, as a writer, I have to keep in the air all the time. I can't let one of them fall.
What is the one I can't hit?
Writing, reading, and experiencing.
Reading?
Reading. And by that, I mean I could really easily just write and not be reading anything worth a darn. I could get into just reading, and I've had times in my life where I've read 8 hours a day and more. I usually read about 5 books at once, plus what I think of as pretty serious magazines. I don't read the newspaper at all, because it's written for fifth graders. And it's been a long time since I was in the fifth grade. So if I'm going to learn about the world, I'm going to have to figure out some other way to do it. So I'm balancing, I'm writing, I'm reading worthy, important stuff, and I'm a worthy reader. I come to stuff as a reader who I want to be one upon whom not much is lost. And then I come to it, and I also have to be experiencing, and I want to put a caveat with that one too and say experiencing genuinely and deeply, very authentically, what is going on, having a very real personal world. You know, the insurance adjuster's problem or the policeman's problem, somebody has an accident, there's 20 people watching, everybody gives them a different account. I don't find that surprising at all. I find it absolutely as it's supposed to be. You know, our realities are all different. So anytime I let one of these drop, I'm not writing very well anymore. By reading, I mean reading contemporary stuff. If I'm operating a lot in poetry, I've got to read contemporary poets, and then read a little less contemporary, and then read modern poets, and then read slightly dead poets, and then read pretty dead poets, and then read really dead poets. So I go at it backwards in the way they taught me in school, where we started out with Beowulf and went forward. We never got any farther maybe than about Stephen Crane or something, Edgar Allan Poe. Writing my best, writing often. I think everybody has their own approach to that. Some people get up and write early every morning, some people don't write every day. I'm not really a daily writer, but I write often, and then experiencing. The beautiful thing of this is that each of them feeds the other. And that's one of the reasons to do art. If nothing else, a payoff for trying to operate in a creative mode would be that as we're practicing the art, in this case writing, it causes us to experience more deeply. Who's had a serious photography class? Okay, you know then that you see after that in a different kind of way. If you spent just several hundred hours drawing with a pencil or a pen, you see line in a different way. If you play piano, you hear music in a different way. Well, you experience the world in a different way, you know, by juggling these three. About writing, I could say that we can talk about writing. There are books you can read about writing. And then you can listen about writing. The the most effective way to learn about writing personally is to write. So that's my proposition, is that we do some of that today, again, in that low-impact way that I've described. The three stages for me of writing are warm-up, write, and fix-up, and I'd like today to get through the first two. They never told me when I was in the sixth grade or the 12th grade or much of undergraduate school that in order to write, I ought to warm up. They just told me to write. Write your essay in class. Write your essay and hand it in tomorrow. What did you do on your summer vacation? You know, who do you think should win the election? But I think athletes warm up, musicians warm up, writers warm up. One way to warm up is just with words. We'll just do two kinds of warm up today, but there's bunches of them. And you can devise as many as you want to yourself at home somewhere. These are just a couple that I happen to use in there through experience. I've learned they're pretty easy to grab hold of in a short amount of time here. people like us, people who have a kind of a different way of handling words, either in our minds or as we write or talk, have favorite words just for the sake, I mean, just because we do. And they don't have to. We don't have to justify them or anything. We just have favorite words all the time. And this I noticed in myself when I was a kid, and it's still true. I noticed that a lot of the other kids didn't seem to have favorite words. They were just utility objects to them. You know, something to talk with, something to think in, something to write with if made to. But they didn't really have favorite words. And so what I'm going to do is just pitch out one of my favorite words, and then I'll time you. We'll just do 30 seconds and jot down everything you can that this word ignites in you in 60 seconds. It might be sentences, but I doubt it. It might be some sentences and some stray phrases. It might be word associations. It might be wild associative leaps. It can be anything you want it to be. In the end, I'll ask if any of us want to read it, but if you don't want to, you don't have to. I like this one a lot, but I can't remember how much I've... Well, let's just try it. I'm going to use this one in a while. Leather, L-E-A-T-H-E-R, go. And stop. Okay, anybody got anything you want us to be privy to? Don't mind being privy to?
Leather, cowskin, shoe, belt, western dress, snake, something, skin.
Terrific. Anybody else?
Leather, smooth, rough, tough, supple, strong.
Okay. More? Thank you.
Leather, blue, black, brown, soft, pliable, strong, sturdy.
Others?
Shoes, couches from animals, coats versus...
Anybody else?
Shoes, sandals, belts, purse, cowhide, ostrich, fringe shirt, and gaucho.
Great. I didn't expect to hear the word gaucho said all day today, so that's good. Megan?
The interior of Daniel's parents' new Saab mixed with the smell of blue extra gum and gray flannel.
Wow. Okay. Big associative kind of... Anybody else for wooden, for anything else?
He threw me ashes.
No, sorry. Wow, yeah.
Texture, character, alive, vivid.
Great. I have stairs, banisters, carpenters, slats, barrels under wooden. Those are under wooden, not under leather. I'm just joking.
I have decaying.
Oh, okay.
Decaying
wood, yeah.
Like from the trees.
Yeah, a lot of that to witness around here. Well, so that's one way to do it, just words, just plain words. What is writing made of? Words. Now, we can have all kinds of things we can hang on it and say it's made out of ideas, it's made out of philosophy, a bunch of stuff. Well, I'll just tell you one of my pet grievances. See, paintings, we get ideas when we look at paintings. We get ideas when we listen to music. But what are they made out of? Paintings made out of paint. you know, it's made out of paint put on a canvas. And to the degree to which it's organized in a way that we can appreciate it, then we get ideas.
Well, there's something odd that happens when we're talking about the art that is made out of words. A lot of people think that the poet in particular, but the writer in general, is a philosopher. And I say, balderdash, you know, that they're opposite ends of a continuum. Because writers use words, people kind of think we're intellectuals. Well, I mean, I don't think I'm a dummy. But I wouldn't say that I operate as an intellectual in my art. Poets are trying to have a very concrete world. How do you spell concrete? Was the other day. Sometimes they change on me. We're trying to have a world made out of actual images, actual happenings, actual, you know, I mean, all poetry and all writing is both completely fact and completely fiction. The philosophers are trying to abstract the world. That's the opposite of concrete. So, artists who write are way down here. And we're not philosophers. We know that it's made out of words. And that these gentlemen and ladies make their stuff out of ideas. That's what they're headed for. That's what they're starting with. That's what they're ending with. Abstractions. Okay. So that's an example of warm-up and then an example of me going on a tiny tirade. Tiny tirade. Now let's just do a little writing. I'll give you a notion, but you can always have your own notion. You don't need me to continue writing. There is not a day that I cannot write something. Might be pretty poor, but I can write. And I never know which one it's going to be. If I'm going to write terrific this morning or if I'm going to write disgustingly today, you know, stupidly. My friend Bill Stafford, William Stafford, always said, if you're not writing well, lower your standards. You know, just accept whatever comes along. So, let's see. Idea starters.
Find that what I've experienced, which is if you will write, you may feel inspired, you may feel it's great 2 days later.
Yeah, right. Oh, sure.
And
oh,
likewise,
sure.
You feel like it's rather minimal and you find that it is better than you perceive.
I have found both of those things thousands of times, so I recognize exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it needs what I call a shelf life, you know, some time to cool down and, you know, get away from it a bit and so on to kind of really make a more astute decision about whether or not it's something worth working on and continuing with. But, you know, every time a painter starts, sometimes it just ends up a sketch, and that's what it is, you know. And it never is something that you want to work on. I've made a lot of and used to teach a lot of pottery, and people want every pot to come out swell. Well, they don't. You know, some of them are worth following up on, and some of them aren't. So that's the way it is with writing. It's risky business. We're just trying it out and seeing if anything happens today. You know, it doesn't mean I'm voting for inspiration, but inspiration, there's something I know that does kick in some days and enlivens us. I'm trying to think of what we've done lately so we're not... Well, let's just do this one as a quick one. We'll give you 45 seconds because I'm really generous and we've got a lot of time, okay? So for 45 seconds, begin with this phrase and then write any old thing. Again, sentences, fragments, change what you think of as subjects, anything that you want to. Just begin with the phrase either I remember or I recall, and then have a memory, and then run it down. Make yourself keep writing. All right. Yeah, this is one where we don't get credit for penmanship or for being smart or anything. It's just something. Here's about how much I got.
And most of mine seem to be pretty straightforward declarative sentences. Okay, we're writing by the pound at this point. If you can picture any idea that you've had about you know, the explosiveness of Van Gogh or something, that's what we're doing. We're just pounding in big areas of purple sky and slamming in some crows and washing in a bunch of wheat, and we'll sort it out later, you know. So later we'll have a look at that. Let's do a second one. Again, 45 seconds. Let's see. Have either of you done that first day back from Canada? Okay, that's a good one. Put down the phrase, that first day back from Canada. Then I'll say a few words and then I'll start you. That first day back from Canada. Now, one of the things that this one can do is introduce more a component of imagination. William Blake, the lithographer, painter, author, held, I mean, this wasn't just something he thought, this was one of his innermost convictions, was that imagination was both an additional sense, S-E-N-S-E, you know, smelling, tasting, touching, like that, and it was also a core creature in us and a core personality and you know, a freestanding agent, that imagination. And so he had characters who were simply operating within a bunch of, you know, created people that he thought of as real, and then an imagination character. Rather like that book, its title is Trout Fishing in America, and a lot of people think, well, that must describe an activity. Well, in that book, Trout Fishing in America is a character.
What's the name again?
Trout Fishing in America.
Trout Fishing.
Yeah. So, on that first day back from Canada, it can be that you've gone to Canada, or you've gone to Canada several times, or you've never been to Canada in your life and don't much care to go. But use that as a starting phrase, and then let that lead you into something. If you've never been there, pretend you have. Lie, you know. Put down that first day back from Canada, I something or other, or give it somebody else's name. Helen did something or other. I wheeled into the driveway and the dog was dead in the driveway, you know. Just let something happen and then just keep letting it happen. And I'll give you one whole minute on this one. Ready? Go. Mm-hmm. Okay, now look at each one of them, if you would please, and mark, by each one of them I mean one of them beginning I remember and the other one the day back from Canada, and mark anything that seems to you, it might be by a circle around a few words or a particular sentence or a line under a word, that seems to you to be particularly promising or surprising, something that you wouldn't have guessed would get there, or in the case of the I remember, something that you hadn't thought of a while, some detail. Just whatever. Well, let's take about 45 seconds and just kind of mark on it a little bit while it's still steaming. Okay. Is there anybody who wouldn't mind reading either or both of theirs? Just for the good of the group.
Hello.
Great, go for it.
The first I recall?
Whichever or both or backwards or anything.
I recall growing up on the farm, teasing a gander, coasting downhill in a red wagon, walking barefoot to the field, riding on the cultivator with my father, playing Indian in the grove, riding horseback, picking wildflowers at the roadside as I was going for the mail.
Thank you. You want to read the other one too?
Okay. I just got back from Canada.
Oh, okay. So this one worked for you. Okay.
I just a little bit.
Yeah.
That first day back from Canada, I tried to recall to my father things I had seen. The wheat fields on those rolling plains and also the flat plains. The farmsteads with neat groves, some well kept, while others with junky cars and old combines. Oh, yes. the out-of-date thrashing machine sitting up on a lone hillside with a flag waving, left to decay. Being a farmer, you understand the elevators for grain, the working combines, and the trucks in the fields.
Thank you. You also write fast, which is a good habit to have in this biz. Somebody else?
The first one is, I recall my grandmother, petite, fastidious, but above all, her staunch Christian. She loved to read her Bible. She carried a sweet pea to church along with a hanky, but her chicken soup floating the parsley was out of this world. In her kitchen was a fainting couch, calla lily. First day back from Canada, I think I took a little bit, is that sadness. The money exchange, what do we do with this money? Good old USA, happy memories to retrain, the laundry to be done. Goodbye mountains, precious memories to preserve, culture change, friends Canadian to keep. Beauty, I can't remember, only, I can't even remember writing. I wish I was back to the good of living. Newspaper and mail.
Sounds dandy. Good bunch of stuff. Anybody else? See, I'm like an auctioneer. If you just slightly move, I know that you're ready. It's kind of the way you breathe there for a second. Okay.
I recall the night you came back and we sat on the swings in the park behind your house, and sticking to our bare feet, which were wet from walking through the grass after the rain. My rage steaming like the rain on hot asphalt, I told you to go to hell as I walked home, shoulders straight, one foot in front of the other. I think that's how it's for.
Okay. How about the other one?
That first day back from Canada, I got too much junk mail, and there was a half-full carton of sour milk in the fridge. I had left the windows open, and it rained on my bed in the morning. I didn't feel like unpacking, but I knew if I didn't, I'd continue to live out of my bag, rummaging for clean underwear and my toothbrush for another week at least. That's all.
Great. Listening to that and doing this at the same time. Yeah, living out of a suitcase, sometimes don't we do things like that to ourselves? You know, I've done that. Just come home and just not unpacked. Just kept messing out of that suitcase until it was empty, pretty much, you know? So there's just about four things in there and you don't even know why they're in there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that happens to me. Well, okay, now I should also, I write when you write and then when you offer, I offer. So I should always do that. So I will. I remember fishing with my father. His pant legs were dark up past the knees where he'd waded in the water. His brow was loose and open. My line was, I have two words, taut or tight. I could use either one of those for different reasons. The field behind was yellow, once stuffed with fish. Our animal lumbered through the brush. That first day back from Canada, the Chevy shuddered to a stop. I have junky cars in mind, only I'm driving it. That first day back from Canada, the Chevy shuddered to a stop at the curb. Never ran again. Never even walked. Had to have her towed away. A death trap, that car. The lawn was 17 inches high. The cat had run off, returned 3 weeks later, sleek and fat and shiny. The neighbor had not collected the mail. It was shoved through the slot and all over the pine floor. 13 gallons of spoilt milk stood in the box on the porch. It's kind of a calamitous return here for this guy. This guy is a lot like me. He's not really me, but he's a lot like me. Some surprising things for me were some sound linkages. I remember fishing with my father. We've got alliteration in that line already. His pant legs dark. Up past, so we've got pant, only I wrote plant, but anyway, it's pant, and we've got past the knees, so there's some interior sound there of the vowels. Let's see, father links up with the end of the next phrase where he'd waded in the water. then a kind of a paradoxical comparison. His brow was loose and open, but then my line was tight. The field behind, so somehow the imagination has shifted back to, you know, or the memory has shifted back to behind the creek bank or the river bank, whatever, was yellow, once stuffed with fish. I often have this image near the edges of my mind of Indians putting fish in the ground where they planted things. You know, so here we've got, we're hunting for fish out here, but the fields behind were stuffed with them at one time, dead ones, but you know, so the, I don't know. Then the sound linkage of lumbered and brush. Okay. And it's stuff like that then that one can jump into when one gets into the fix-up part. In terms of fixing up, I'll just mention a couple of words about that, and then I have something I want to read to you from my own stuff here. Not because it serves as a grand example, but because you should know that I do write and I do publish. And so in order to have faith in me and stuff, maybe come back Wednesday, then you'll want to do that. A word that I heard that at first I winced a little bit, but then I said great when the next word came, was it rolling plains? Who had rolling plains and then after that flat plains? Okay, rolling plains, I come from plains, and I know I come from, you know, those, that kind of rolling plain. And then I, at first I went, rolling plains, well, that's kind of usual. It's, you know, and then it said, and flat plains, and then I thought, oh, well, here's a person who knows their plains, you know. This is a person who's qualified to use the word rolling plains because they know the difference. There's a word that they nationally use on the coasts right now for my part of the country. I came from Kansas, and the word is flyover people. We're all thought of as flyover people. Not anybody you'd ever want to meet, not anything you'd ever want to look at. And that reminded me of this word that often comes up when people have leaves. They're rustling leaves, you know. When I was a child, the first few times I heard that, I thought it was rustle. I thought it was my cousin Russell, you know. The leaves rustle in the evening wind. Wow, what's Russell doing in this poem? And I would invite you to find those kinds of things in your work that are too easy to have put down there, you know. If you're going to have rolling, make sure you're such an expert that you also know the difference between rolling and a flat plane, you know, and then I'll buy rolling. You see what I'm saying? Never have leaves rustle, ever. Never have streams babble, you know, or brooks babble. If you can possibly help it, I mean, make yourself have 50 good reasons for leaving that word in there. That's some of the stuff we consider when we fix up. A lot of people worry about newer writing, particularly newer poetry, because it doesn't have end rhyme. And now this one rhymes with that one, and this one with the next one, or these two, and those two, whatever the end. And that's the least of our concerns, is whether or not it rhymes at the end. Some people have this, I mean, what we typically talk in is iambic pentameter, so that's why it's such a poetic device, that's why Shakespeare. And so some people already have that sort of rhyming facility very much embedded in them, but you don't have to. A lot of poetry now uses slant rhyme, where it'll have rhyming here, maybe the next line will rhyme at the end, and in the same piece, you know. So this is interior rhyme, same line of rhyme. This is slant rhyme. This is rhyming, you know, like we like down here, in older poems, but it just happens to be that it's in the middle of a line, you know. Also, there's sound linkages. In one of my poems, the sound, the short I sound, it appears really many more times than would naturally be there if I had just written it once. But because I fixed it up, it's called Family Movie. And at the end of this movie, the character who was my granddad, who was playing with the machinery and flipping it backwards and forwards to make us kids laugh, at the end of it, he burned the film. This is, you know, back in the 50s, and it was not great film in the first place, and the machines weren't all that terrific either. And so he burned it, and it came apart. When that happens, of course, this last wheel back here has the tail on it. It's going click, 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 click. Well, as a poet, I didn't have to say that. I just could have a lot of words that would have this sound in it. And I think, I trust people. I think
that, and especially the more people have read and are sensitive to words and so on, that subliminally they register that. Click, 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 click. So these are some fix-up concerns. I'll say that if you want a piece to be more loving and warm and to do with nest and home and so on, put in root, root beginning, soft beginning sounds. Mama, papa, baby, milk kinds of sounds. Things that begin with those letters, actually. Okay? If you want something to sound more mechanistic, more traditionally masculine, more collisive, or more violent, or whatever, put in sounds that have K's, G's. I mean, you can do that in a lot of places, you know, where you'll have one word and you'll think, now what's another word that's pretty near that meaning? Anyway, I can stand the nearness of it, but it starts with a G's, you know, or K's, or L's. If you want something to, you know, have a rich openness about it, use long vowels. A, E, I, O, U, as often as you can. If you want something to stop, end it with a K, like this one, dark. Okay. This stops down sound. So if you put that at the end of a sentence, it'll stop that thing down. Also, D is a good one for stopping things down. If you want the rhythm of your piece and the piece, you know, say your piece is about a river, and you want it to just keep moving and flowing and so on, or it could be about anything, but it's something that you want movement in. Use the forms, make up the syntax that will have you ending with a lot of L-Y's and I-N-G's, because they tend to move a piece forward. Yes, go ahead.
What was that for, the L-Y name?
For keeping something moving forward.
Oh.
Slowly. Starting. Those words move a piece forward. Those sounds just move a piece forward. I'm not making that stuff up. It just is in the language.
Excuse me, can I ask about the poetry where you had a slant line and the one about the poetry with a slant line?
Yes.
And then rhyme where? What was?
Oh, there's interior rhyme when you've got it rhyming in the same sentence.
Oh.
That's another example. You've got middle line rhyme, which was those two that were lined up with one another. There was a big bar in them, but they're not end rhyme. They don't rhyme at the end of the line, they rhyme in the middle of the line. You can have poetry where the rhyme starts at the beginning of the line. All of these are simply devices for cohesion to keep the piece from falling all over the page. You're kind of running out your socks there. Let's see. We do have time to do this. This is amazing. We almost never have time to do this.
Well, here's the old-fashioned rhyming, and I realize it doesn't seem...
Oh, there's nothing wrong with it, and I write that way sometimes. If the poem seems to want to do that, and it seems like it would be in the best interest of the poem for me to do that.
I try to get away from it, but it's... more of a habit.
Well, sure, and we all grew up with it, and we sing hymns, you know, et cetera. But there are even hymns, there are even very old hymns that don't rhyme. You know, they're wonderful old Finnish hymns and Norwegian hymns and so on that don't rhyme. And they didn't in Norwegian either, you know. We just think that all songs rhyme and so on. But it would take a long discourse to describe why we've gotten away from rhyme so much, but a part of it has to do with the fact that all the arts come along together in history, and so you know, dance. My daughter took 9 years of ballet and 4 years of modern dance, and I am a big fan of dance and go to it as often as I can, as long as I think ahead of time that it's going to be good. I can't stand bad dance. But just as a popular dance, say, let me just try to get these straight in line. In the minuet, everything was symmetrical, okay? There, you know, and everything was repeated even numbers of times, you know. You would never dream in the minuet of somebody going out, in, out, only three times and then twirling, you know? Because it's not symmetrical. It's not even, okay? So in ballet,
classical ballet and so on, things are in even numbers, and you do two of them to this side, and you do two of them to this side. You never do two of them to this side, and then over here, you know, it's not symmetrical. Let's just look at interior design for a second. The way it was always done when I was growing up was you had a couch, and then you had a table over here, which was exactly a reproduction of the table over here. Okay? And then my mother would place, and my dad went along with this just fine, it's okay with him. We had two lamps, they're exactly the same. Okay? And either you had one big painting, a sofa painting, that was right in the middle, or you had maybe a couple of them, but they were the same size, same dimensions, and probably the same subject. Ducks in this one and ducks in this one, not ducks in this one and a cactus in that one, you know? So everything, you could split this living room right down the middle, it's a mirror, okay? Well, now, this isn't really done all the time. It is done sometimes, but it's not done all the time, because one of the things, so that's again, like the dance, symmetrical. But one of the things that we like now in our design is asymmetry. So we put the couch here, and we put a table here with one photograph in an antique frame, and some kind of cloth hanging around it that's rough and nubby and so on. And then we put one of those lamps here, you know, that bends way over. And then we put one painting. I would never do this because I would never put a painting behind a lamp. But we put one painting there, and somehow it balances, but it's not asymmetrical, but it's not symmetrical. Okay? So things come along. Dance goes along, music goes along. Jazz is not symmetrical. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with something that is, like a hymn or like classical music or whatever, but jazz isn't. Our time today, I mean, if I could take the time to relate why our time today and our own rhythms, our own lives are more like jazz now than they are like classical music. You know, staccato, things coming and going throughout the day, a lot of unpredictability in the day. So jazz is kind of a reflection of what is now, whether we like it or not. I mean, we may not like jazz, we may not like what is now, but it is. Poetry is the same way. It used to be symmetrical, and it used to have that rather predictability factor, you know, built in. Now it doesn't need to be. And some would say, and if it did all the time, it wouldn't really reflect what our lives are like now. So art as a reflection of life is really what you're talking about. I still read loads and just tons of poems that rhyme, but I wouldn't want all my poems. Sometimes I write a poem and it does rhyme, and then I unrhyme it because it feels to me like it shouldn't be rhyming. You know, that's just the way it came in my head. This is another good beginning for you, and maybe we'll do this one. You can think about it a little bit, but if you come back on Wednesday, you might put this phrase down just in case it causes you to. I can't believe this one, but I am getting here. This is kind of an odd little phrase. Oops. I am the one who. But interestingly, it seems often to. I discovered it by accident one day, and then I've been teaching with it for a long time, and it seems to kind of work out. And I want to try to relate a second idea out of this. Now, I almost never read my own poems in classes, but I have. There are reasons to, and so this is one, and it's not that you should write like me or that you should think that I'm a genius or anything. It's a very plain spoken poem. It's called Nest, N-E-S-T. I am the one who lies down in the pasture and doesn't get up in any of the hours of the long afternoon. I am the one who wants meadowlarks to whistle again and again and again, from telephone lines without waiting. I don't count the birds or the songs. I want them to stay just many meadowlarks.
I am the one who weeps over a nest of empty shotgun shell casings in the snow on two wet knees. Then I am the one whose pockets call out to his hands. I am the one who drinks strong coffee beside the blue pickup truck, then drives with both cold windows fully down. I am the one who tries on the river. She fits. I am the one who collects things to ponder, rents memories at high risks, no deposit, no return, and credits closets with nothing. Stack it all on the curb for the Salvation Army collectors. Take the last wet grass paper, turn the key and slide away before the street awakens. I am the one who listens to the wind when she stops in my hand. Now, this character is a person a lot like me. Just because it's in the first person me doesn't mean it's entirely me or that's completely in confessional mode. I'm talking the formalistic school of poetry called confessionalism. But it's a lot like me. Now, I want to relate this to the notion of, well, I want to say, first of all, it's got a lot of images in it. Okay? That's one way that you can tell a highly loaded piece of writing is imagery. In my own view, all of the other devices that I use in the writing of poetry, imagery, alliteration, whatever it might be, sound linkage, the things I've been talking about and so on, are all in service of trying to discover metaphor. Not invent it or contrive it, but to discover it. I say that there's already metaphor all around in the world. It's one of the things that God gave us to absorb. Metaphor, I'm using in the broadest sense when we talk in poetics, I mean both simile and metaphor. In conversation, we call it analogy. Jesus taught by method of parable. So in metaphor, we say, this thing and this thing would seem to be completely dissimilar, but I notice that they're similar in this at least one way. One of my poems begins, the snow along the road, let's see, under lumpy caps of frozen snow, the sage along the road has become cauliflower. Now, one day I was driving in a blizzard between Elko, Nevada and Salt Lake City, and there was this sage growing right next to the road, and when all these lumps of snow had packed down in there, and everything was, you know, pale in the wintertime, it looked like cauliflower, you know? Now, that's a metaphor. Now, did I make that up? Well, I don't think so. Did I impose that on my reality or the landscape that's out there? I don't think so. I think I just noticed it. I think I just discovered that day. And to me, ever since then, and that's been 8 or 10 years ago, every time I see sage that's got snow drifted down into it and packed clumpy and hard, it always looks like cauliflower now. You know, so I have that as a part of my repertoire of you know, just a thing about life that I notice. So that's one of the benefits. When I was talking earlier about, you know, juggling reading, writing, and experiencing, by experiencing that visually in what was to me a real rich way at that time, and writing, you know, it added to the richness of my experience, which was an otherwise kind of scary drive, kind of a scary and boring drive, actually. You know, you were either frightened or bored, you know, through much of the drive. Now, let me test where it began originally in the first little draft, and sometimes I have to make a poem over and over 80 times, okay, before it's done, or I think it's done. It began down here with this one. I am the one who weeps over a nest of empty shotgun shell casings in the snow on two wet knees. It wasn't quite like that, but it was like that. Where a little circlet, a little piled circlet of shotgun shell casings were in the snow. And I was kneeling by them. And they weren't supposed to be in that snow there. And the configuration of them, I know just about enough about guns to know that they came out of something that was, you know, a repeater type shotgun. You don't just load two barrels and so on, but it keeps pumping out of the side. They fall in a similar place. There's a little bit of irony in there.
This is called a nest, which is where life is born and nurtured and so on, but this nest is a death nest, really. It's a nest that's not made out of twigs and spit and whittle and so on. You know, it's made out of shotgun shell casings, and they're not supposed to be here. Okay? That's where the poem began. And the whole poem was just about, it was a one incident poem. Single incident, single memory, single definition of who I am. This is gonna sound a little wacky, but this is, I'm just gonna have to go ahead and say this anyway because it's the process of how it actually worked. Again, I don't know a lot about guns, but I know that in the case of a rifle, you've got a bullet, and this is all full of powder, and it shoots this one big thing from here over to there, okay? Well, these weren't bullet casings, I found. They were shotgun shell casings. So I decided to take my cue for how to reconstruct the poem to talk about many different facets of me. A shotgun shell, of course, is a cylinder, and it's got a cap back here and a little bit of powder, and it shoots all these little BB-looking things, you know, in your shot, depending on how big they are. And they fan out, they give you a wider bunch of stuff, and you're just hoping some of them will hit the birdie, you know. If all of them did, you wouldn't have a birdie. And so, rather than just talk about the single incident, I talked about many incidents of this character that's quite a lot like me, okay? And so this character is not just a character who finds oh my gosh, look what I've done. Put the wrong color on the wrong. I don't know where it goes now. Somebody's going to pick this up expecting it to be green. But it's not, it's red. So now this character, this speaker in the poem, that's not the ones, you know, describes himself as being one who lies down in the pasture and can just kind of lays there. You know, L-A-Z-E there, you know, kind of throughout the afternoon, not really not thinking about the time, and kind of needs that kind of, not to put too fine a point on it, but that kind of reflective or meditative, you know, time. One who, you know, is sort of absently listening to the meadowlarks and just wanting them to keep going, but not wanting to say, well, I heard 17 meadowlarks, or I heard a meadowlark whistle 17 times. It just wants it to be pretty open-ended and so on. So it's setting up some description, some expectation about the character. Pretty tipped back, easygoing, meditative, reflective, kind of quiet, things to do kind of character. And then, boom, I'm the one who weeps over a nest of empty shotgun shell casings. Then I am the one whose pockets call out to his hands. And what is that picture on a literal level?
Young boy.
Child, young boy, shy, you know. It's not, I'm the one who jams his pockets in his hands, but somehow the pockets are calling to them. There's no place else for them to go.
The child, the young boy's mind did, they would come home with their pockets full of stuff.
Yeah.
That's why they would pick up, they would pick that stuff up.
Yeah. So here's one where the, well, here it has that the pockets are not calling out to the shotgun shell casings, they're calling out to the hands. Just the hands.
From a male point of view, there's a helplessness.
That's a rather helpless posture, isn't it?
You can't do anything.
You can't fight anybody, you can't, you know, make any decisive movements, you can't open the truck door, it's resignation. Mm-hmm. You know, the pockets are calling out to the hands.
I like that analogy. That's something that rang a bell in my experience.
Then several other quick things. Somebody who drinks strong coffee beside the blue pickup truck. Well, when? It seems like it might be just after they found the shotgun shell casings. Okay. The coffee's strong. The pickup truck is blue. Both cold windows fully down. On a literal take, what is that? Hey, you got to have some fresh air and some cold air and stuff in there just to kind of, what?
Keep yourself awake.
Yeah, keep yourself awake and keep yourself, it's almost an act of flagellation, too, you know. Just keep cold and just keep, you know, just because of the confusion of this, when this ignition activity and the sorrow over that and so on. I am the one who tries on the river. She fits. Well, have you ever tried on a river or a lake or a stream and it didn't fit? It touches you everywhere it's supposed to, you know. There's an allusion there to other river poems, which is a very long-standing, you know, from the Greeks, from the Chinese, from the Native Americans, river means time, the flow of time. It also means a great many other things poetically, but that's one of its main ones. And in this case, the time fits. You were mainly made out of water, isn't it? Something like 96%? And so if we're standing in a river and the river fits and we're mainly river on the inside, we're pretty much in our element. We're pretty much where we're supposed to be, you know, in time and time fitting, etc. Okay, that's just to say that, and then several quick things, you know, rinse memories to ponder, collect, you know, credits clauses with nothing, leaves all the possessions out for the Salvation Army, steals away in the car before the street awakens, you know, early in the morning, da-da-da-da-da. So that you get a shotgun approach to this character, lots of little snippets that one has to then sort of add up to say, who is this character that is talking? Rather than just going on and on and on and on and on about the audacity of somebody shooting a shotgun where they're not supposed to. Okay, so that's a case where you know, the form of the poem is deliberately built around a particular image, just a shotgun shell. Okay, and so the other things about the poem are packed in around that. Now again, that's not to tell you to write like that, or that's not to anything, it's just to be honest and say, these are the things I think about when I'm in a stage called fix-up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's helpful for me personally, because I, as you say, rewrite, looking for, you know, good words that are interesting.
Yeah, how to capitalize on the stuff that quickens in you, and how to pry out that stuff that is doing nothing for the poem or for you or for your own experience.
How do you deal with, maybe you don't have this experience, I find when I write, when I sit down and I do the let yourself go, the stream of consciousness, and then you go back to look at your images and, as you say, find the moment in there that's interesting that you want to build off of. It seems like I always find myself, when I go back to do that editing step, is all of a sudden I start to intellectualize everything, and so I take out this very sensual image and replace it with a very rational, intellectual image.
I would guess that about you just from your reading the warm-up stuff,
yeah,
where a lot of people had concrete words coming down from it.
I'm a
but
very sensual.
But yours had the descriptive words of the, you know, adjectives and so on going along there. And I have had to think about this question before because it's been asked of me, and I've had to think about it before because I've asked it of myself. And so I'm gonna lean a little bit on what I've said before, but I'm also gonna try to be right here. You know, I owe you more than that, just to haul out my old easy answers. My way of doing it is going to be different from yours, and it's certainly different from a lot of people's, but here's how I feel about it as I'm going along through the process, is that for a long time, the intellect is the enemy of my poem, or my piece of work. That for a long time, I want to just hold it off, that my head, you know, is going to try to jam it up with what was really a more feeling kind of thing. See, we think with words, but we feel with something else. Now we have words for feelings. You know, we say maudlin or sad or joyous or whatever, but those aren't the feelings. Those are descriptive words of the feelings. And I try to stay with the feelings as long as I can. It sounds to me like what you have is something that I've experienced, where I'm starting in the rush of the feelings. But I wonder if, as men, sometimes we don't go back and try to sort of hide behind these constructs of the intellectual and the crafted and the, you know, so on, so that we don't expose any of those feelings. I mean, I'm being pretty blunt with you, aren't I? But that's how I feel about my own stuff. is that I look at it and I think, oh my gosh, I don't want anybody to know that I feel that way or felt that way or had that disposition. So I'll fix it all up with the construction of a smart and rational man. Smart and rational man. You know, she may have it on a t-shirt, you know, with a cape, you know, rather than feeling man.
Does
Amory kind of have a head? It may, I think so. I don't know.
The image I keep coming back to when I write, and I've written for a long time, much of it recently for the past 30 years has been, you know, proposals,
right.
You know, business stuff.
Didactic.
Which has to be, you know, as technical as literate. But every time I sit down to try to write, I'm conjuring up images of English teachers and stuff like this from back when, and, you know, to construct, to make the perfect sentence, to dump, you know, things out. And I keep wanting to say, get thee behind me, mm-hmm. Satan, and allow me to flow. And I haven't found a method to break that.
I haven't found a method that works every time. I'm lucky if I find a method that works sometimes. And those English teachers, I was one of them for years, prep school English teacher, et cetera, et cetera. I never really had the same, I was an English teacher who wrote, which in those days was kind of rare, you know. But, I mean, I wouldn't presume to teach writing if I didn't write. But I know what you're talking about, and what's happening is there that during that middle stage, you know, you got your warm up and then your write stage, and as long into your fix up stage, I mean, you begin to let the editor speak to you, but just in moderate little increments of increased volume, I would say, you know, because otherwise that little editor will kill your piece.
I'll give you an example, because we're going back to the first little thing
sure.
You wrote, because I did exactly what I'm just talking about. What I wrote down the first time, as you said, right, I recall the moment when I first felt tall. Not the knowledge of having been told I was tall, but the actual sensation of tallness. And even before you said start saying, you know, start stopping,
right.
I had gone back and I had scratched out not the knowledge of having, and it changed it to it wasn't the knowledge of having. I edited it, you know, mm-hmm. rationalized mm-hmm. it, cleaned it up. Then I went down, I said, it wasn't the knowledge of having been told. Then I scratched that out and went back to, no, not the knowledge of having been told. And then I went down and edited the sensation of tallness to say sensation and realization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Add another $4 word in there. That'll legitimize it. I know these feelings. I've had that kind of stuff. And Megan, you've had it in painting, you know. And any of you who have been working in an expressive mode know that you can do something and it has a freshness and a whimsy, and I've got to go make announcements. But anyway, as soon as the bell rings. But sure, we can go in and plaster it over for some ego reason or for some reason that has not to do with expressive mode, that has not to do with, you know, opening ourselves out, you know, to the reality as we feel it in our interior life. I know we can do that, and it's tough to resist. That might be a place if any bunch of us get back together on Wednesday. I'll be here for us to kind of talk about. Well, if you want to do something with "I am the one" between now and then, remember to warm up with something first. You know, warm up with a little something, and then just right out of that. Or if you want to fix up anything that you've got here, that's great. And if you want to entertain more, you know, sort of discussion of poetics like you're talking about here, just how to get out of the way of the art that's in you, and that's what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you know, how to not jump in the way of the art that's in you. I say there's a lot of art in everybody, but a lot of us jump in the way of it, you know. I hope that the art's big enough that it's like jumping in the way of a diesel train, you know, that we will not stop it. But sometimes it's not. It's just kind of a little bicycle coasting toward it, and we can absolutely, you know, wreck it by stepping in its path, as you're talking about here. But thanks for that question. That's very, very thoughtful and poignant thing to consider. All righty, they're going to ask us for supper. You were all so nice, nobody jumped up and went off to wash their hands before sunburn and hang, so now we're going to all eat dirty hands, I guess.
Oh, thanks for coming. Yeah. You sneaked in and then...